Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So over 65 years ago, an English woman who had been a Buddhist since her teens and was a music teacher and an organist traveled by what was the long route and then from England to Malaysia and then to Japan. That trip is that she made and the years she spent there are, in a sense, the reason we're here now. This retreat initially was scheduled for 2021, for August of 2021. And then COVID intervened, and we moved it to online, and then our town burnt down, as some of you would have heard, and burnt to the ground, and we were evacuated to a hotel, so it didn't seem to be good to either travel or to attempt anything online. So, you know, this is finally doing it. In March, I ordained that fellow over there, Reverend Owen, and he began to ask me all sorts of questions that I had never thought of before or considered as to why we do things the way we do them and why don't we do them otherwise. And I realized that when I was training with Reverend Master, I didn't ask a lot of questions about the way things were or could be or anything along those lines. That was because I was desperate. I was 21 years old when I first came here and quite miserable. And being desperate, I just tended to, you know, whatever it was we were doing was normal to me. You know, if it was, we had goats, for example. We had a goat herd, and whenever I've mentioned that to people subsequently, you know, new people, they, you know, you had a goats, what were you doing with goats? Well, we just had them. So, whereas I'm going to be talking in this retreat about the same things that I was going to be talking about in the original one in 2021, and that is about what Reverend Master Peggy Kennett learned about Buddhist training in the East and why or how she taught that to us. And one of the things from responding to Owen's questions was realizing that her approach to a lot of things was quite different than you find in the books. Okay, even though she had was qualified to teach in a very orthodox Zen tradition, we're about as kosher as they get, actually. But her approach was quite different. And so I thought over this week I would talk about various aspects of this, of her, how she taught and what she learned in Japan and Malaysia, basically starting off with tomorrow morning about the self. Then I think karma and rebirth, mindfulness, meditation, precepts, and realization. One of the things that happened with Reverend Master Jiyu in Japan is that when she went, she did have a certain amount of Japanese karma, as many people do who take up Zen. But she was not, how do I put it? When she arrived in Japan, they did not do that which happened with many Westerners who went and studied in Japan, which was keeping them at a distance. Generally speaking, a lot of people who studied Zen in Japan during that period lived separately. They didn't live in a temple. They lived in like a hotel outside, meditated, came for session. And Reverend Master encountered unvarnished Japanese culture, and it actually thoroughly disabused her of whatever notion she might have come with that there was something intrinsically sacred about Japanese culture. Okay, given all she went through in Japan, the politics and all the rest of it, she actually was not given to very much things Japanese, you know, by the time I met her. I remember I did out a little set of Japanese characters on a little tea caddy I had. I've always been a sort of hopeless romantic, if you know what I mean. And I remember I was told by one of the chaplains, would you mind taking that away? Japanese characters kind of spook Reverend Master, remind her of all the fuss that she went through. And that experience, and also another thing for which we are very grateful for, is that she went more or less accidentally to Malaysia. I think everybody's heard when we do Welcome Joyous Vaisak Day for Vaisak. She wrote the music. The words were written by an American monk living in Malaysia. And it was a contest, believe it or not, a Buddhist writing contest. And somebody has set it to music. Now, how many Buddhist musicians do you think there were, Western Buddhist musicians, in the 1960s? So she won the contest. And when they heard she was going to Japan, they said, why don't you stop off in Malaysia? You have to stop anyway. Malaysia was connected with Great Britain at the time, so there were, you know, visa and other things you could stop off and do. And Hong polished the cup that she received that's up in the OBC office, because Hong was a little girl there, not to embarrass her. And Hong's aunt actually was present at Reverend Master Chief's ordination. That experience of Malaysia also greatly influenced how Reverend Master Jiyu thought about training, because Venerable Kim Seng, like Koho Zenji, spotted, if I can put it that way, quality. Okay, they saw somebody who was determined enough to be possibly a Dharma heir. So they went out of their way in regards to what they taught her. Kim Seng explained to her the actual meaning of bowing, as is transmitted in the Chinese tradition. And of course we wear Kesa clips because of them, because of the Chinese in Malaysia. Japanese tie theirs. And actually all sorts of nuances within the way we go about things. Because Reverend Master always said that she was, in a sense, trying to steer a course between the great formality of the Japanese Soto sect and the great, if I put it that way, sincerity and sort of relaxed nature of the Chinese. She once did a Dharma talk showing the comparisons and showing an altar in Japan and an altar in Chenung Teng in Malaysia. And the altar in Japan was, everything was meticulously so, you know, spotlessly, all the rest of it. The offerings in the nice little bowls, you know, all the rest of it. And in the temple in Malaysia, in Chenung Teng, the offerings to the monks put on the altar included like Coca-Cola bottles of various sizes. And that type of informality. And she once said to us, in terms of visiting other temples, she said, if you go to a Japanese temple as a Soto Zen monk, there's a great deal of formality that you have to go through. You know, you have to have the right person, the right rank, the right incense stick height, and all the rest of it. But she said, if you attempt that with Chinese priests, they become embarrassed, and they'll run away rather than be singled out. And I found very much that to be true. So that experience also colored and influenced the way we go about things. I mean, one of the things Kim Seng did was take her to the Snake Temple, which is where in Penang? Or Snake Temple in Penang, where there are snakes. They hang out over the statues, and they live there. And when she mentioned that she was frightened of them, he had her stay overnight there. And so those things, how do I put it, influenced. So the way Reverend Master Jiu went about things in teaching what we have now is, of course, because she was trained in those traditions, we were taught how to do the form of the formality of the Japanese tradition. As I said, we're quite kosher. You know, the going up in the toes, for those of you who remember that, what Reverend Owen did. And the are a lot of the aspects of what we have here are related to that. But one of the things that made what Reverend Master Jiu brought over different was it was to look beneath the culture and the forms that in which the Dharma is embodied or moved, if I can put it that way, from country to country. To look beneath it and to focus on the actual training of oneself in daily life. I, for example, have attended very pleasant Zen picnics in Vancouver. We were invited. And it was all quite nice, but it was radically different. People asked my congregation whether they practiced archery or wrote, could any of them, you know, write Japanese characters? Nobody knows how to do it, if you know what I mean, because they were not connected with the Dharma through the particular culture, except as a conveyor, if I can put it that way, of what she taught. The advantages of doing that has been that one isn't intimidated by a particular culture or a particular language or a particular set of ways of doing things. You know, we do them because that was the way she learned. Do you see what I mean? We sit in Zazen, but we have people sit on chairs for Zazen if that's necessary. That now that throughout the years has been with Reverend Master a struggle and a koan that she very much had to work with. What do you let change and what is essential? When I first came here in 76, fall of 76, one of the things that struck me, I had studied Buddhism for some time, and one of the things that struck me was how much her way of going about training and her teaching resembled what I had read in the old scriptures about Shakyamuni Buddha's approach. That once you get beyond the fascination with a particular culture, you can see what the Buddha and Reverend Master were aiming at. And as I say, this is one I was going to say blow my whole wad right now or anything like that, because I don't do the way I do talks, as some of you will know, I don't do from notes. I more prepare, sit down, and then see which way it moves, depending on the people. So this emphasis on daily life and what you actually do. Not what you think. Like one of the things which always strikes me is River Master used to, when talking about mindfulness, she used to do a slightly funny thing about that verse, we live in the world as if in the sky. We live in the world as if in a fog, you know, which many people do. And she was constantly saying to people, get your brains out of the sack, you know, and stop dragging them behind you throughout the day. Pay attention to what you're doing. And she would be quite forceful in terms of that. Well, most books I've read about mindfulness don't talk about paying attention to what you're doing. They talk about cultivating a particular type of mindset, which is actually somewhat removed from most people's daily life. The Dharma is not meant to be something that can only be practiced if you have a certain level of income, education, or time. There's and I almost never recommend books. I'll just make reference to it. It was a book I came across called Buddhism for Dudes. And it was in the remainder section of the bookstore. I don't think it was very popular. But I was going through it, and the guy had written my first meditation period of the day. Okay, and there was a little cartoon of him sitting on the toilet in the morning with his hands like that, his pants down around him, and sitting upright. And that really struck me. And because that was very, very much Reverend Master Jiu's approach, not so much sitting on the toilet. But the aspect of, how do I put it? Dharma practice and Zen practice is not meant to be easy, but neither is it meant to be impossible. It is not meant to be, how do I put it? Without a great deal of effort, but it is not meant to be something restricted to particular backgrounds. And unfortunately, like Buddhism entered Japan, for example, it entered Japan at the aristocratic level, at the imperial level. And so there was a lot of early Zen, for that matter, particularly among some of the schools, that stayed on that level. Because in those days, for example, the peasant class could not become monastics. You could only become a monastic if you were the aristocratic class and if you could read and write and all the rest of it. Dogen came from that class of people, but his entry into practice did not come through that. He, as you know, he became a monk. His mother passed away. His father had died in the wars. His mother, on her deathbed, was afraid that he would be killed in the revenge things that were going back and forth in Japan's civil wars of the period, and so she urged him to renounce the world. And interestingly enough, in his life, he went to see his uncles, his mother's brothers, when he wished to become a monk, because he was opposed by, because Dogen was related to the imperial family. So for him to renounce the world was a big deal. But he was able to do it through his mother's relatives. Anyway, that's sort of a side. Because I'm trying to keep within parameters. So this is what I'm going to be talking about in the upcoming week, is how what she learned in Japan, the link between that, actually, and the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, and what we do now in our particular practice, and why it has a particular flavor. Okay? Some of you are nodding, you sort of get what I'm looking at. One of my congregation members, Michelle, who lost her house in that fire, but in any case, she was a nurse. And one day, one of her colleagues, having seen somewhere that she was a Buddhist, she said, "Michelle, you're a Buddhist? You don't act like a Buddhist." you know, because Michelle had no of the cultural aspects of it. And I often frequently emphasize that particularly Soto is called Farmer's Zen for a very good reason. Because you could practice it in whatever circumstances you were in. You did not have to have anything. Do you understand what I mean? To practice? I've noticed frequently what I've seen in Buddhist magazines in the West, in America, is a lot of people have questions like, how do I practice if I have children? You know, how do I practice if I have a husband? How do I practice if I have a job? How can I organize my life so that I can put them aside while I practice? Which, to some degree, is not an attitude that certainly was in the Buddha's time, where ordinary people were practicing, were listening to him. Some of my favorite stories are from that era of quite ordinary people. What was the one of my favorites? I've got a lot of them. The Buddha was giving a Dharma talk. There was a young woman who had previously been training with him. She was a weaver. She had to finish off with the cloth. She arrived late for the Dharma talk. The Buddha was waiting for her, and everybody was wondering, why is he waiting? You know. And so she comes, turns up, and he says to her, where have you come from? And she said, I don't know. And he said, and where are you going? And she said, I don't know that either. And it said the group of people listening to the Dharma talk said, you know, this foolish woman wasting the Buddha's time, you know, saying silly things. And the Buddha, it said, seeking to clarify, asked her, he said, why did you respond? And she said, well, you knew perfectly well I had come from the weaving thing, so you knew where I'd been, and I was coming here, so I was sure you must have meant something different, and that you were asking, did I know what the causes were that brought me into existence, and I don't. And how do I, you know, do I know the ones that proceed on from that, and I don't. I think this talk is heading towards more stories than I meant. But one of my favorites, because once you get that thing I'm talking about in terms of what Reverend Master Ji was talking about, training of daily life, then you can understand these stories. Otherwise, they're kind of mysterious. And one of my favorites is and you can just see it happening. Female monk, she returns from an alms round. She's quite elderly. She goes into the little house or whatever, little cell. It's dark towards the evening. There's a little candle, a little lamp. And it says, before she sat down, she turned around and looked at the seat. Now, that's a monastic rule. It's so you won't sit on snakes and scorpions, okay, in India. But you can just see, I think, you can just look at it from her perspective. You can just imagine yourself in the situation, your own hesitation, you see. You think, well, do I really need to turn around? You know, one of those silly rules they're always telling us we need to do. You know, why not? You know what I mean? You can see it going through her mind. But she sat still. She turned around and looked. Then she sat down. And she then drew the lamp down to extinguish the wick. And she said, the great dark broke apart. Now, what is the most important aspect of that story? The most important aspect of it is when she decides to sit still and not simply follow what, you know, the mind is running after. If you can understand that, then you can see how that realization of the Dharma is not something at far distance from us or impossible. one of the difficulties of it being encapsulated into a culture is when we read some story of, you know, Koan story, and we think, how do we get in that particular situation? You know, like your master used to refer to the story of the monk sweeping and striking a tile against a bamboo. Okay. And people in her day, Westerners arriving in Japan, looking for the right type of bamboo, even though it was a Chinese story, and entirely missing the point that what was going on there was somebody in a similar situation. The decision not to give in to one's impatience, one's annoyance, but to do that which needed to be done. The intersection between daily life and understanding and realizing what the Dharma is about is not a huge distance. All you really have to do is to sit still just at that particular moment, to let go of the whirling mind, and just for that moment. Whether we see it or not at that moment, that opens. Okay, that opens into, if I can call it, reality. Maybe that's the best word for it. And that is why so much emphasis in the Zen tradition is put on daily life. Not in order to be able to do, calligraphy or tea ceremony, but to be able to open ourselves to that reality. And of course, as is always taught, that is not, there are of course moments, okay, that arise. But there has to be the continuation of training in order to keep it going. And I think I'm trying to keep within parameters, so I'm going to end there.